Hi, I'm Tara Lee, and welcome to Starbeing, your cosmic journey to self-discovery, higher consciousness, and spiritual exploration. This podcast serves as a guiding light, illuminating the path to wisdom, healing, and conscious living. Let Starbeing ignite your inner light as we transcend limitations and tap into the universal consciousness that unites and empowers all of us. Welcome to episode 8, Vedic Wisdom and the Sovereign Self with Acharya Shunya. Acharya is a name given to a master spiritual teacher of lived Vedic knowledge who teaches not only by word, but through modeling by behavior. And that is why I am so honored to have interviewed Acharya Shunya. She is an award-winning and internationally renowned spiritual teacher and scholar of Advaita, which is non-dual wisdom. She is a classically trained master of yoga and Ayurveda. She is the first female head of her 2,000-year-old Indian spiritual lineage, and she has dedicated her life to sharing the Vedic knowledge for the spiritual upliftment of all beings. In this episode, you will experience her unique and thought-provoking perspectives that have made her a true leader in the spiritual community. Her wisdom is so impactful that it moved me to tears during our interview. We dive into deep soul level concepts, and I hope it will inspire and uplift you. Welcome, Acharya Shunya. I am so excited to have you on Starbeing podcast. I've uncovered your work a couple of years ago now, and through studying Ayurveda and finding your book, Ayurvedic Lifestyle Wisdom, and then your Sovereign Self book. And I find your teaching so refreshing. And I feel that this teaching is so needed at this time. And I feel that Ayurvedic knowledge and the Vedic wisdom is really coming back and is really needed. And I would love for you to speak about your path, and would you consider it a spiritual destiny or a karma? And I'd love to know about your lineage and how that has unfolded for you.
It must be karma. I think there were 7 billion families in which I could be born, but I was born in the family of Vedic teachers, and our family traces its ancestry back to an ancient yogi couple, Rishi Vasishtha and his wife Yogini Arundhati. And our family is very much steeped in the Vedic tradition of Advaita Vedanta, non-dual spirituality, where we trace an inherent oneness in all beings' consciousness. And it's iterations in yoga, how yoga becomes a path to find this supreme oneness, and also Ayurveda. So for me, Ayurveda is not just about the body or the mind or even both of them. It's really about the spirit flourishing. And the body and the mind are containers of that non-dual presence within. So you might have noticed, and I think that's what's appealing to you, is the spiritual quality of my writing. Because Ayurveda has been reduced to a body trend, a fad. Yoga has become too commercialized. And I go back to what I know to be timeless. And in writing that, I find solace, because I don't live in that world anymore. I live far away from India now. And but probably the nature of my inner garden is still very much connected to the garden in which I grew up. I was very fortunate to have a family that lived those values. They didn't give big sermons on it. They just lived it. And when I find a disparity in what we are talking about and how we are living, how Ayurvedic medicine is not allowed to stand on its own feet and has all kinds of crutches from the modern fads and the modern science. I find like, wait a minute, we can just go back to the simplicity, the essence of these teachings, and it's enough a lot of the times. Similarly, if I want to practice Western medicine or I want to benefit from it, I don't want a doctor who's practicing a mixed bag of therapies. I would like to go to a Western medicine expert. So I try to stay one and shape more experts in these domains. And probably that desire to remove the riffraff, the sediments, the dirt, and bring forward that pure pearl, I think that there's always a subtle intention at my subconscious level. I'm always groping for that ray of light. And I think that's what you are connecting with. And thank you for seeing it.
Yes, and I love that is about your teachings. They are going back to the truth for me and always, and because I'm such a truth seeker, I always feel that Vedic knowledge is, like you say, coming back to that source of truth and how we can keep bringing us back to that and having that integrity, in the knowledge. And that is what I love in your book, Sovereign Self. You talk about your having this time-tested sacred text of purifying the mind. And I don't hear many teachers speaking about this. And I really wanted to ask you, when you talk about these sacred texts and purifying the mind and how important that is, before we seek a path maybe on meditation, or why meditation isn't working or is more challenging than it should be, can you speak about what is purifying the mind? How do we purify the mind, and your concept of the sovereign self, that entire meaning?
For a long time, a meditation was a tool, and now it has become an end unto itself. And it was a tool to discover a greater presence, a higher self, which is sovereign. It's not dependent on what's happening in your life circumstances. It's not happening on how your mind's perceiving it, screaming or panicking. It is sovereign in its own bliss existence consciousness. It was a huge doorway into radical well-being, really, to connect with the self. And the yogis found it, the ancient yogis, and they laid out all these pathways called bhakti yoga, jnana yoga, karma yoga, vasana yoga, sadhana yoga, raja yoga, to just reach there. And meditation was a step among some of the other steps taken. But if you are using a tool, you should know what you're looking for. And that greater context is provided by what is the written or the first oral and then written tradition coming out of this, the East, specifically from the Indian tradition, Hindu Vedic tradition, such as the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, the Brahma Sutra, and many more such texts. Give us first an idea of that there is an invisible presence within us. It's invisible, but that doesn't mean it's not present. It's the ultimate presence. It lends life to our body and mind, and the ego pretends like it knows it all, but it's really working off of a fraction of the light of the truth within us. And a good investment of our day-to-day life would be spending some time looking for it. And instead, meditation was removed from its Hindu Vedic context and changed into a prescription. 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes in the afternoon, and people sit there wondering if it's over. And even if they are deep into it, at the most, they relax the mind. But to relax the mind is just a tiny benefit. But we walk out of that meditation without ever touching the treasure that lies within. If we only knew to look for it, the good thing is that the self is self-revealing when we look for it. We don't know its signs. We don't know when it is the mind and when it is the self talking to us. And so, you know, then we leave it to the Americans to package meditation. And now we have as many teachers, as many types of meditation. But they are all still at the realm of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And the soul is a bad word now. And spirit is mumbo jumbo now. And the great teachings of the ancient rishis and yogis on consciousness, that one self that is a universal self, the self in you and me and our listeners is one. So if we touch that, we also connect with unity. We go beyond diversity. We go beyond hatred. We tap into infinite love, infinite light. And even droplets of that knowledge, of that knowingness, changes our life. I don't know if I'm holding on to the whole treasure or just a few droplets of the self within me. But my life is 1,000% changed by this knowledge. And it happens with the weeping, lamenting students who come to me, who within days start transforming. So when we let go of the traditional knowledge, the timeless teachings, when we started reducing these great traditions to Hinduism, Buddhistism, when we started creating prescriptions out of it, yes, we could reach the masses, but probably in that process, we lost the unique offering. So now in my latest book, which I'm not sure what I'm going to call, but it's Evoke. I want to evoke the mysticism, the mystic within us through yoga. So I'm talking about traditional bhakti path, traditional karma yoga, upasana yoga, these mystical practices and insights. So once again, I'm back to the original containers of this knowledge, which is our traditional texts. And I'm, you know, milking them to bring back the insights. And what is sad, and I'm going to complete my share here, is that even the teachers who came out of India, in the desire to translate an esoteric knowledge to the Westerners, even though the Westerners were, you know, they would go whichever way the teachers would take them, they started doing reductionism on the knowledge. And they started choosing to impart postures and meditations like a prescription, more than really saying, why are we doing this? And where do these practices belong in a whole field of practices and insights? So the Indian teachers themselves reduced it, packaged it. So it's not Indian versus American. In fact, I have many American colleagues who are, like me, interested in the real deal. Mm-hmm. So it's not about nationality or East and West, North and South. It's more about discerning to know the real deal, the real truth versus a fraction of it. What if I diluted and dumbed down for dummies? That version.
Yes.
Unfortunately.
Yes, I feel that so much, because in my experience of studying Ayurveda, having that just reduced to, like you mentioned, that a body of work rather than the complete spiritual aspects and underlining of it, I've definitely experienced that myself. And I'm really looking forward to Invoke, your latest book that you're working on. And yeah, I definitely think that is needed during this time. And with this knowledge And with this inner essence that we have inside of us, could you speak about why that's important to uncover with our karmic path, and why, like you say, that I think there's this discernment really came up when you were speaking, how important it is to discern. And I think there is a lot of spiritual teachers, and there's a lot of pop spirituality that is happening at the moment, and people have these busy, distracted lives, and they're, like you say, they're trying to grasp onto these prescription things because they know that they need something, they know that they need that band-aid. How would you say to work on discernment? And is that the purification of the mind? Is that where you think that discernment comes from? Because to me, that is the key in all of this. So when you're reading something, discerning it with the soul, does this feel right? Do you have any tools for that? Or can you speak on that discernment and how you can lean more into that?
I think discernment does not come quickly, because most people's consciousness is covered up with the sediment of materialism. And when that is all we know, if we've seen the sun from a certain room in a certain building with a certain angle, we think this is how it is. We've never been out. We've never seen the splendid 360-degree version that night is an appearance and the sun is always shining. We don't know. So going within is often not enough, even though that, again, is a prescription for everything. The first prescription in the Vedic tradition is to find scholars, to find the knowers of not just the truth from their heart, because they could be faking it, but they are the knowers of the truths from the Yoga Sutras, from the Bhagavad Gita, from the ancient tradition. So, but they should not also be parrots parroting what is written dogmatically. They should clearly be awake. That knowledge should be flowing through them. And it's really only by listening to such podcasts, by being in such company, by hearing about the reality versus the pretense of reality, the illusion, does it become clear? And the reason the Vedic tradition doesn't begin with reading the Vedas is because they are esoteric. They are hard to decode unless there is a knower of the Vedas decoding it for us. And that is why, along with writing, I try my best to be on every potential podcast, and I get so many invitations. But the desire to be on different podcasts, tending to different communities, is not for myself, because my books are already huge bestsellers. It is to reach different communities. It's a mission for me to really say that, look, there could be possibly more, and never ever settle for tiny prescriptions, even if they come from the East. Ask for more. Try to find out where that knowledge is. I'm sure reading Sovereign Self itself opened many questions within you. And it's good to have questions. I may not have given you all the answers. Other teachers may. But at least I create a fertile soil that questions and dares to question all the way to who am I. And these prescriptions don't work for the body and mind. And we will need to find something that is beyond the body and mind, because the body, mind, and everything else is in the sphere of impermanence, transience, change, decay, death. There is only one thing, the observer within us, that shall observe its way through birth and through death. It was there. The true you was there before you were in this body, when you were in the mother's womb, through the journey through the womb, through different ages of 2, 5, 18, 22, 30, whatever is your age now, and it will be there ever present as you leave this body, which is no more than a clothing for you. Mm-hmm. To know that essential self becomes important, because then that is the answer to, that is the end of soul. That is the end of anguish. And there can even be excitement in death. There can be excitement in change, because I feel it. No fear, fearless. Why? Because you know that you're not ending. And when you connect with this eternal essence within you, you begin roaring in every area of your life. You begin playing. Because after all, it is the change that afflicts us. So you sit there in the mind and you try and watch the gaps between the thoughts. It's so tedious. Let the thoughts do their own thing. The knowledge is really important, that you are not the thoughts, you are the observer. Right now, you are the observer within you, not the observer within me. Not the speaker, not the questioner, not the answer. We are not actors, we are observers. So we have two selves, the actor self and the observer self. We all, this actor self has a name, an email ID, a horoscope, and whatnot. But it's the observer within us that's eternal. To know this is the business of the entire Vedic tradition. Yoga is not separate from the Vedic tradition. If Vedic tradition is the philosophy, then yoga is the actualization of that philosophy. It is the execution of that philosophy as a path, as a lived lifestyle. And bringing the two together is the work of teachers like myself. We are far and few. I could clearly create a Shunya Yoga, Shunya Ayurveda, put little things in bottles and sell them as Shunya this and Shunya that, and be totally caught up in a worldly version of what I know. But instead, I'm choosing to write those thicker books which people like you like to read, because I know that even if I can touch a few people, I've made an impact. And they're going to touch a few people, and they're going to touch a few people.
Mm.
So it's time for truth. And some of us just have no choice but to tell it.
Mm. Oh, I love that so much, because, you know, when you speak about that awakening within the self, and that, you know, that consciousness that is eternal, and I feel that it is something in our daily life that is important to keep coming back to, keep awakening to that, because we do get distracted, we do get caught up. And you mentioned about the materialness in this reality and this society as being really is the benchmark of success. Having this, having that, having this title, this is important, and as seen as, yeah, the ultimate. And so with pursuing this journey to the self and to the sovereign self, it's not prioritized, but I see it as the most important journey. Like, this is the most important journey, because this is the karma that we're creating in this lifetime, and the journey that we've been on and the journey that we're going on. I see it as though I want to spiritually grow as much as I can in this lifetime. And then in the next lifetime, that, yeah, it's, I've done everything that I can for the soul to grow, to evolve to its full capacity. Is that what you see your journey as in this,
yeah, in this version of yourself? Excited. I'm very excited for my next life, if I have another one. There are some things in our willpower, like choice of how we act, how we grow, do we evolve or devolve? And there are some things in the control of the greater mind. The greater, you know, the self of all beings is known as the Supreme Self. And we do not know if we've reached the ultimate in our lifetimes, but there is always an effort. There is a looking at, is my response coming from dharma, which is dharma is not just goodness for people of your religion or your color or your gender. It's a universal goodness, universal ethics. So responding with dharma, engaging with dharma, lovemaking with dharma, going to picnic with dharma, just being a regular human, but making sure it's within the dharmic framework. And that the second goal that's very important is moksha, which literally means in the process, every day, do I take out time to touch something invisible but potent within me? Something that's one with the divine consciousness. It may take a minute, it may take half a day for me, but I stay steeped in those contemplations. Even if I'm driving the car, I may, you know, look all around me and not just see it as people and cars, but I see it as divine play.
Mm.
So I have constructs within my mind that helps me unpack a spiritual understanding that's subtler than what I'm seeing. That helps. But definitely I agree with you that the evolution of our consciousness, the evolution of our from outer being to knowing and celebrating the innermost being, finding its connections with God and God beyond religions and anthropomorphic versions of God as a human. The Vedas promote God as divine consciousness, which can be or become anything. So Shiva, Vishnu, Brahma, Ganesha, these are not human gods. These are symbolic representations of an infinite abstract self, the bigger self, bigger most self, biggest most self. And but it includes all versions of God. So there is some great omniscient dimension, God, G-O-D, which is also within us as the self. So there is the G-O-D outside, the super self. There is a G-O-D inside, the personal self. Knowing this is knowing that is knowing this in the Vedic tradition.
Mm.
You don't have to have a separate religion to figure out the God outside and psychology to figure out the God inside. That dimension is one. Knowing it makes us better people, happier people, healthier people, satisfied people, fulfilled people. So, to answer your question, my journey is not just about my next life or how I'm growing. I also want to enjoy my humanity. I want to be fulfilled. And my spirituality is helping me do it. So it's a unique spirituality. It doesn't ask us to have a distaste for sex or material things or, you know, just dehumanize ourselves and become this strange, holy versions of ourselves. More than holiness, wholeness.
I love that, especially I find, yeah, just how you speak is and how you write is just very liberating and refreshing. It's like a breath of fresh air when I listen to you, because I think that is so important, that divine play. And I myself I grew up in a very restrictive religion, and it sort of had this framework that, you know, you can do this, you can't do that, this is what makes you a good person or not. And I find in your book and your teachings that I've been exposed to that you do give this opportunity for the reader or for the student to really deeply contemplate, and I feel especially Sovereign Self, it really made me at a lot of points, I had to put the book down and I really had to contemplate it, because it was quite challenging in the fact that I really had to look at my internal belief system to see if I was integrity. And that's what I love about this book. It just always brought me back to, where am I getting caught up in this Maya, the illusion of this world, and how can I sort of bring myself back? How can I pull myself back? So I'm very grateful for this book. I actually pulled your books out from my shelf and in preparation for this interview, and I said to my husband, I was like, look how well worn these are, because I'm always sort of going back to them. So yes, I am so grateful for your teachings and that you're bringing this truth into the light. One concept that I loved within the Sovereign Self was around karma and versus the law of attraction. I've actually heard you speak about this before, and it was so, again, refreshing the way that you frame the law of attraction versus the law of karma. I'm wondering if you can speak on that, because there is quite, going back to that pop spirituality, that focus on manifestation, on this law of attraction, and we're forgetting about those karmic implications that we have.
According to the Vedas, we are eternal beings, and when a desire arises within us, we have the capacity to fulfill it, even if we need a couple of more lifetimes to do that. And we may take on different bodies. The only caveat is that when we perform action, we create a reverberation in consciousness, and it's going to come back as a mirroring circumstance. It may not be the exact same thing, but to the degree of which it is positive or dark, our action, we will have a positive or dark circumstance mirror us, come find us in a different lifetime, because this is how things work in circles. You don't just do something linearly and you're done. It's going to come back to you. So that's the law of karma. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction from the cosmos. And that is why out of the blue, sometimes positive things happen to us. Strangers help us out, or there is sudden fame or a windfall of wealth. And sometimes out of the blue, you may be just sitting in a parked car and a truck comes and crashes you and you get nexed. You sustain a lot of injury, or friends turn enemies. People you trusted betray you out of nowhere. That's because it was meant to be that in the cosmic circle of karma, you will experience some suffering or some joy. And accordingly, you have a mirroring of dark or light circumstances. This is the law. And if we look around, it feels like just like you have the law of gravity, it's there. You can't see it, but you just have to believe in when you see what's happening. You throw a ball, it comes down. You jump up, you come down. A tree uproots, it doesn't go up, it falls down. Even a light feather doesn't fly up constantly, it comes down. So just like you can see the workings of the law of gravity, which is a physical law of the Supreme Self, there is a moral, and this is the moral law of karma. And clearly Earth, according to the Vedas, among the 14 spheres of existence, Earth is a sphere of existence where we have not been born to achieve what we want. We have come here to fulfill certain karmic circles. And that is why we see all the diversity in endowment. Somebody has everything, somebody has nothing, somebody had everything, but they are reduced to nothing. Somebody who is nothing becomes the owner of everything. There is all this karmic charge and discharge going on, undeniable. In the middle of this very clear law comes up the law of attraction, and it poofs away any kind of limitations by humanity. And it tells you all you have to do is dream up, dream up a BMW or dream or think about, a big house or the ideal lover or that your parent not dying, and it will happen. Against all biological and other laws, it is like, it's up to you. And if you fail, then you just didn't dream it right. So there was nobody carrying any accountability. The liability was all yours. According to the Vedas, yes, we are powerful magnets. And yes, we do, as we think, so we believe. As we believe, so we behave. As we behave, so is our character. As is our character, so is our destiny. But there is a cause and effect. It's not just simply desiring something that's going to happen. And it takes away all the responsibility, the hard work. It's simply using the brain as a dreaming engine. And it's true that, say, I wrote Sovereign Self, I must have dreamt of writing it, and hence it's produced. But honestly, it must be like the 30th version of what I started writing. There was hard work. There was editing. There were days when I couldn't connect with my inner muse. There were days when I was disturbed. There were those days I wrote chapters that my publisher said no. And then there were days when I ended writing a chapter and then said no. There is so much that goes on in terms of cause and effect, cause and effect. It is not this magical dream and realize. I don't want to be a doomsday sayer, but the fact is that the law of karma gives us actual potency. If you want to change your life, starting this moment, become conscious, awake, responsible, this moment. Mm-hmm. What you drink, what you eat, how you speak, how you invest in your relationship, how honestly you are, that's what's going to reverberate back to you. The wealth or the good job opportunity may come from speaking your truth right now. And it's not exactly that you think of wealth and you get wealth. Wealth is not just money and dollars, baby. Wealth is the wealth of character, the wealth of affection, the wealth of family, the wealth of resources, human and other kinds. So it's a much more complex universe than they would like to do it, but definitely sold the millions of books.
Mm.
And I, in the work I do as a spiritual teacher, meet so many people who became even more depressed and more disappointed with myself because they could not attract what they wanted. When they understood the law of karma through my book, Sovereign Self, or through my direct teachings by Joy, becoming a member of my wisdom school, they realized that, okay, if I'm going through a difficult time, the buck stops with me. I can start making a dent in the difficult time by just waking up early, being grateful to the universe. Now I'm starting putting out positive energy. And gradually, they see and I witness for them their life changing, one choice at a time. So one system totally just gives you free radical permission to be more and more materialistic, more and more desiring. Leads to the downfall of society. And the other gives you the capacity to make a difference by changing your choices. See the difference?
Yes, that is such an empowering lens. And coming back to that self-responsibility, I feel that is so important because I find that empowering to know that it stops with me. Like, I have the ability to, if my circumstances aren't great right now, what is that next thought that I can choose that is going to be in greater alignment to where I want to go, where I want to be? And so I find that when you first come across this concept, I feel it is very hard for the mind to grasp, because I feel in society we want to blame circumstances or we want to blame others. But for this law of karma to know that we are responsible, and everything that we've created in our life, we're responsible for, is, yeah, I find that the most empowering of all. So yes, I love that within your teachings as well. So I feel that is so important. And I would love to ask more going into this spiritual truth that we have. When we're uncovering and awakening the self and seeing through the illusion of Maya and forgetting who we are and getting back in touch with who we are, why do you think this is such a hard process to keep remembering daily to, yeah, just remember who we are and keep on bringing ourselves back?
I think you've asked a very key question. It's like, you know, when we fall asleep and we dream up stories, skyscrapers, building cities, and people that we've never seen before, or maybe they're dead, but we see them again. And it becomes our reality in that moment. And if you are thirsty in the dream, it's not enough to reach out for water on your dresser. You have to look for water in the dream. So the Vedas describe three levels of reality. One is this everyday transactional reality in which you and I are having a discussion on a podcast. There is another private reality that you and I are purview to in our own minds, when we daydream or we dream at night. It's our subjective reality. And then we wake up from it and say, oh, no, transactional reality feels more solid, right? And it's in this transactional reality that law of karma works. It doesn't really work in your dream reality. Not exactly. But it works here. The moment you wake up, you realize you're a king or a beggar because of the law of karma. Right? Mm. But the Vedas say there is one more waking up to do. This is also not your final reality for you or for me. We just happen to be playing some kind of 3D roles, just like you play 3D roles, 2D roles in your dream, you're playing 3D roles here. And in dream reality, time and space changes quickly. Whereas in this transactional reality, time and space tend to have somewhat of a sequence. It's a shared time and space dimension. But it's up to you. And if you wake up from this reality, you will realize that you were never really this body or this mind. You were never born, you never died. You were only dreaming of this whole story. Mm. That knowledge, and the more experiential it becomes, you start taking your transactional reality or this role, like I take my role as an acharya or as a mother, seriously, but not 100%. For me, the sovereign self within, the true nature of who I am, my body is playing roles of being mommy, wife, teacher, the mind and intellect, but I belong to me and to something else. And I want to wake up to that. So these laws, law of karma or law of attraction, whatever version they apply only in transactional reality. They don't even hold 24 hours a day. They don't hold for the 8-9 hours you're asleep. Just like a beggar can also daydream, he's a king, she's a king. Reality breaks up. What if we woke up to our truth? Then all these laws will fall apart. And this happens through the deep meditations, the enabled by the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita, where you touch the truth of who you are. And the moment you touch that, lifetimes of karma accrued over lifetimes just breaks apart. When you become a free person, leading a much, much different life than you are supposedly meant to be leading.
Mm.
if you look at my astrological chart from a Vedic perspective, which is karma, I should be leading a much worse life than I am. You know, more disease, more physical disease, more accidents. But I don't have those things. And one of the reasons is you are not completely consumed by that reality. And so this takes us back to the new modern discovery of neuroscience. Whatever is your thinking, your subconscious believes it, and your body and your life becomes that. So the invitation of the self-knowledge from the Vedas is to blast all these limiting stories and to lead a storyless existence with a lot of sovereignty and autonomy. And every day when you wake up, you can say, how do I plan to lead my life today? There are not so many barriers, internal and external, in the form of circumstance. It's more free. You make a choice. That's something. I hope I was able to answer and not just.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. So many important things that you brought up there. And I love what you mentioned about the astrological chart, because I think even systems like that, being able to transcend them and not get stuck in them, and having that as an empowering lens. And I feel that astrology can be very disempowering and putting you into a box. And yeah, I think that is very important to mention. And what you were speaking about, that detachment, even though you didn't say detachment, of, you know, knowing that we aren't our physical body, another important thing, because in this reality, we're always being reaffirmed that the physical self. And particularly now, I'd love to know your philosophy on this with our physical reality and our society's obsession with anti-aging and having that as such a driver. And you're looking at these billion-dollar industries now that are so fixated on our appearance and preserving it. I'd love to know your philosophy on that and how you navigate that. I know coming back to reminding yourself that non-attachment to that physical state. But yeah, I'd just love to know your thought process.
Yeah, in the initial stages, one reminds oneself that I'm not the body, I'm not the mind, I'm the self. But at some point, one's main identity is the consciousness within the self. And then I realize that I have a body and I have a mind, but I am different. So if at all, there are two selves in me. One is the physical self, which people label and name, love or reject. And then there is the self within me, which does not age, which is eternally beautiful, blissful. So, for example, self-care, or body care rather, is a way of life, eating organic foods, healthy foods, following Ayurveda's lifestyle. But the fear of aging does not come in, because the body is under the purview of the law of time and space and change. This is the map of the dimension of consciousness we are in. Consciousness itself does not change, but everything else changes. Even the thought of creating anti-aging medicine is ignorance. It's going against, when cells don't age and proliferate, it creates cancer in the body. We have Shiva, the god of destruction, very important, because when this destruction happens, re-emergence, recreation cannot happen, which is Brahma. So in Ayurveda also, there is a desire to maintain the youth and the suppleness of the joints or the eyesight or the vision, but it's more from a health perspective. But in Ayurveda, there is a recognition that at some time death is imminent. And at that time, instead of giving medication, herbal or any other metallic or anything, it's important to give the person knowledge of their true being, of their deathless essence. So this is the wisdom of Ayurveda. So as I age, as you can see, I don't color my hair. I'm very proud that the body has put in almost 6 decades in this dimension. And an eternal being dwells within me and notices with humor the changes that are happening, and shall be equally curious when it's time to discard this physical body. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing. Such an empowering way to look at this process, and yeah, such a refreshing way to look at it. And again, navigating it through that empowering lens and that not being so fixated on that. I wanted to go back and ask you about the mind. This is something that has been coming up for me quite recently, thinking about how important, and I don't think I've given enough importance to the mind and how important it is to being mindful, yes, of our thoughts. But I kind of feel as I'm going through this journey that the mind and having the mind purified is not the answer. I'm not looking for one prescriptive answer, but that the mind can really impact everything in our reality. And is that how you see the mind and the importance of the mind? Because to me, I think that the heart and our intuition is very important, but I'm starting to learn, like you say, how much the mind can impact the physical body and it can create things in our reality. So I'd love to know, yeah, what you think of the importance of the mind, and do you think that that is the overarching place where we should start and we should concentrate?
Great question. Between the body and mind, definitely the mind is the keeper of the body too. We can't just focus on the body, heal it, give it good foods, rest it, and think everything's going to be okay. The mind and its contents are important. Is it anxious a lot? Is the conscious mind and the subconscious mind talking? Is one loaded over the other? Well, that's important. And from that perspective, in the body-mind scenario, I would say the mind is the overarching piece of in the equation. And the knowledge of neurobiology, the knowledge of the subconscious impacting the conscious, it's been around, but it's really hitting home now. People. The mind is so important that the whole path of yoga addresses the mind. Through bhakti, devotion, it dissolves it. Through karma, it teaches it responsibility and consequences, the karma yoga. Through upasana yoga, it teaches it mystic rituals to make it still. Through jnana yoga, it starts telling it that you're not really that important because you're only a minuscule intelligence compared to the master, which is the self. And once people get that knowledge, Jnana Yoga, the knowledge of the Upanishads, the kind in the Sovereign Self, and becomes their reality, at that level, the mind is not the overarching reality now. It is the nature of your consciousness, your knowledge of yourself that's more important. At one time, how my mind felt was super important.
Mm.
Now I tell my mind how to feel or not feel. It's just my little helper. And I don't take its opinions very seriously either. It's not such a big thing for me. It's just another instrument for me as self to use it in the world. So definitely, we cannot dismiss it. And that's why the beginning yoga practices are all about purification. But later it starts cooperating once it's pure. And in fact, the pure mind becomes a great big friend of the self and uncovers the deeper mystic truths of reality. Yeah.
Mm, thank you for diving into that. I love that, how you speak about that, and so important, because I'm seeing these projections within society about how mental health is declining and with anxiety, and I feel that there is this negative focus on the mind, but I love how you've reframed that and said, you know, making a friend with the mind, and then even, you know, now for you, this is using it as a tool and having that. Yeah, that's exciting to me. I just wanted to touch on your book, Raw Like a Goddess. What I loved about this book is how you speak about, for a woman, the most important part is trusting her own voice. And I feel that you embody this so much. And I just wanted you to touch on, what is this concept to roar like a goddess? What was your motivation, and why did you think it's really important at this time?
You know, unlike Sovereign Self, which I took 3 years to write, and it was a meditated upon position to do it, and I had many versions of it, and then I was comfortable with what I released in the world, because it's such a vast knowledge. How to condense it to mere 24 chapters is the big deal.
Mm.
Similarly, I'm a big believer of Ayurveda, so Ayurveda Lifestyle Wisdom came out after years of seeing miracles with Ayurveda and saying, okay, it's time everybody could have this knowledge for like $20, you know, just out there.
Mm.
Roar Like a Goddess, believe it or not, Hara, just was, I think, Divine Mother's decision. And when I say Divine Mother, I'm not pointing to one specific, you know, goddess. I'm just saying to that consciousness from a feminine perspective. Because I was working on a different book, a more scholarly book on Vedic psychology. And suddenly I felt this desire, like I just knew I'm starting something else, and I didn't know what. And I started writing the prologue that you're referring to about the voice. And I finished the book in 4 months straight. And my publishers just loved the first draft. And then the book's making such inroads all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
There are book clubs around it. There are people, you know, just going to great lengths to roar.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like sometimes your mind not only is your instrument, but when it's pure, it's used as the instrument for the collective.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the world was ready for Roar Like a Goddess. Men and women, teenagers, kids, because parents are reading to their kids, young girls, young boys, they are benefiting. So I get stories from all over the world. Perhaps this body, the body that I have, was born in a patriarchally stained society and a patriarchally stained world, because coming to America was no different. Just the stories of the style of patriarchy changes, but it's still there. North, south, east, west, up, down, everywhere. So, and people are systematically disempowered for their gender or their religious practice or their sexual choice. And so this book was benefiting from my own exposure to when I was disempowered. Mm. And then I've grown so much in my empoweredness, and my beliefs and attitudes just came through. Probably the universe thought I was ready. This is one book that I felt like was written through me, using me.
Mm.
People talk about that channeling and all that. I don't think I was in a trance while writing it. I very much own every word.
Mm.
But the way it started and the way it came out with a gush from within me. And how could I be so unconscious that I needed to write this? I was living it. I didn't know how to write this. It was not a conversation I was having on the public stage.
Mm.
I am sensitive to bringing Hindu motifs and symbols in my writing, because I so want to convey to everyone that this is not just about a religion. This is spirituality. And these are Hindu goddesses. But I think I managed to do a good job anyway, where it was, you know, I have Muslim women reading it, I have Christian women reading it. So it's just, it's a blessing, really. I am equally blessed by Roar Like a Goddess.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. Such a powerful guide. And yeah, for myself, this last year has been using the voice and empowering the voice. And so this was, yes, very, very helpful. And yeah, really invoking those goddesses, and yeah, really relying on that strength as well. It was, yeah, I highly recommend that. I would love to know, Acharya, could you tell us what Acharya means? I feel that this is quite important.
Acharya is a title given to a teacher, but not to every teacher. A teacher who has completed at least 12 years of education in the Vedas, and I have completed 14. So it's given to master teachers and to leaders of lineages.
Mm.
And I am the leader, the first female leader of my 2,000-year-old lineage. I also completed the required education, and hence I carry with great humbleness.
Beautiful. And I'd love to know, where can my listeners deepen into your work? I'm very excited for this book that you've hinted to that you're writing, but with your Ayurveda lifestyle wisdom, I highly recommend this as a guide, because it has everything in there for like complete lifestyle, as well as recipes and things like that, your sovereign self, and then your role like a goddess. Could you, and I have also taken some, I guess, more masterclasses that you have done. I did one on sleep, which was incredible, absolutely incredible. And like I said, I've studied Ayurveda, but the depths of your teaching around sleep just blew me away. So I'd love to know what offerings that you have at the moment and how you can work deeper with you.
If people feel like they want to study with me, they can go to awakenedself.com, which I'm sure, Tara, you will post in the show notes.
Yes.
And just go to courses there, and there are some live courses there and some recorded courses there that you can check out at your convenience. If you want to study on a weekly basis with me, just make me your teacher and study with me, then you'll find a course called The Vedic Way. That's the way, the life. And I teach there. I'm currently teaching Bhakti Yoga in it. That's something to explore. I also have another website, just my name, acharyashunya.com. which will again lead you to the courses. So either one you can remember. And if it's meant to be, you will find a way to be. That's all I know.
Thank you, Acharya. And just before we leave, I would love to know if there's anything else that you would love to leave the listeners with, or anything that is on your heart that you wanted to express.
Thank you, Dara. I think you are an adhikari. An adhikari is a Sanskrit word for someone, a soul that is ripe for knowledge. So it's always delicious to have a conversation with an adhikari. So thank you for just being here on the work.
Thank you. Thanks for tuning in to Star Being. May the wisdom shared resonate in your soul. Until next time, stay connected and keep reaching for the stars. This is Star Being signing off.